copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
My name is Elder Favarin, or Helder Favarin, and I live in southern Spain, in Granada. Though I'm originally from Brazil, I'm also Italian by nationality, but that's where we've been. Now, my wife and I, with our children, and by the way, let me just show you a picture of my family, which has been growing. This is my wife, Anna. We have Mateo, who just turned 5. Raffaello turned 3, and 3 months ago we had our twins being born, so Pietro and Valentina. So it's a wonderful and tiring season of our lives, and I joke that being here is like being on holiday. I'm sleeping overnight. So, but my parents happen to be around helping my wife, and so she's not on her own with the kids actually. Well, I'm sure that one of the things that connects us all is our dream to see a transformed Europe, and particularly a transformed youth. It's interesting that, as many or most of us would know, Europe has more or less 700 million people. At the same time, it has the lowest evangelical percentage of any continent. Around 20 European countries have less than 1% of evangelicals. And we know that Europe is the continent where the church is growing the least. It's interesting and sad that, for example, in Western Europe, when many of us are, in the 1900, we had 99% of Christians, whereas in 2010, 69% of people would consider themselves Christians. Now, that is the greatest decline in the entire world over the previous century. This is a map, a recent one, showing the growth of the church. As we probably know, the Christian church has never grown so much in the world as it's growing today. But we don't see that really in where all those gray countries, some in Asia, and particularly, as we know already, in Europe. That's where the church is growing the least, and some would say it's growing 30, 50 times more in Africa or in Asia when compared to Europe. In 1970, for instance, 8.7 would describe themselves as agnostics. This is Northern Europe, whereas recently, 17.7, we have a growth there, of course, as well. And particularly when we think about Europe, I think we all know this as well, but it's good to be reminded that within the continent where the church is growing the least, there is a demographic that some of us would describe as the most challenging, that is the youth of Europe. And this is, I'll show you a couple of screens. This is produced by Nova Center. These are bulletins called Vista from the Radcliffe College in the UK. They produce several very good bulletins on Europe. So if you are interested to read more, I do encourage you to look at that. And this is a survey that was done to show belief in God in several countries of Europe and the age group. And as we can see, the youngest people are less believing God, we find. And the older people get, or at the moment, the older people are, that's where we see the highest belief in God. In all the countries, we see this. And the opposite happens when we compare the number of people who describe themselves as atheists. So the younger they are, the greatest numbers of atheists that we find. And the opposite happens, as I was saying. I know that many of us know this already, but this is the reality where we are. And that's why I applaud you know, this opportunity and our interest and surely calling to be thinking of the demographic in the world today where perhaps we find the greatest challenge in the advancement of the gospel. And therefore, I just wanted to invite you to think together in this following minutes as I suggest four priorities. I'm sure we could talk about 15 or 30 and you would maybe have other priorities, but let me just bring before you four priorities, four focuses that I think we and the church and ministries and organizations and alliances should embrace as we consider this colossal challenge of reaching out the youth in our continent, in Europe. And before moving on to these four aspects, let me just create a parenthesis here and bring some more numbers that will give us a better picture of the youth, not only in Europe, but also in the world. Half of the world's population are under the age of 30 in our days. By the way, Asia has the largest number of young people, around 800 million. That number has nearly tripled since 1950. According to the World Health Organization, for the group between 15 and 34 years of age, suicide is today one of the three leading causes of death, and it is the second largest cause of mortality in the 10 to 24 age group. That's surely very challenging. Mark Green from London has written, "A culture that cannot answer its own questions is a culture open to an answer." That's why it is so needed and necessary for us to be talking about these issues today. So let me suggest, as I was saying, four priorities or four focuses that I think we all must embrace as we consider this huge challenge. And first of all, I would think that technology is something that we need to be prioritizing in our world today. I would suggest we must be present, we must invest and create content for social media and technology in general. We millennials, many of us are millennials here, those of us born between around 1980 and 1997, of course, love technology and especially smartphones. There is an interesting survey done in the US that shows that 90% of the 18 to 24 year old smartphone owners reach for their device within 15 minutes of waking up. That's surely not our case here, but we know that's a reality for many of us. And by the way, Africa is today the second biggest mobile market in the world, and smartphones outsell computers 4-1. A Financial Times survey was cited by China Daily showed that 92% of Chinese 18 to 30 year olds owned a smartphone. That means that 58% of internet users in China are millennials. And if technology is so much part of millennials, what should we say about even younger ones, Generation Z or Z, or those born after 1997, or even those born after 2000, whom some are suggesting we call them Generation Alpha? My boys are part of this generation. Maybe some of your children or people that we have around us, and it's interesting. In my case, at home, Matteo and Raffaello often want to get hold of our mobile to use YouTube and watch their cartoons. And don't you dare choosing the cartoons for them. They want to do that by themselves. And I remember the other day, Raffaello had my laptop, and he was, you know, impatient that he touched the screen and nothing happened, because it's so natural for them that you touch something and it responds to you. And as we know, those of us who work also with teenagers, and another parenthesis here, I'm aware that when we talk about youth and young people, we are talking about different age ranges in different countries of Europe. Perhaps the UK or some northern European countries, the age range is smaller. Whereas in southern Europe, when we talk about youth work, we are thinking of people up to 30 or 35. So I know that youth means something different in different countries, but more or less, I know we are talking about the same, demographic. And we know that for teenagers today, for instance, social media like social networks like Facebook is really in the past. The parents and grandparents have moved there, so they are leaving these social media, and numbers show us that. And they are migrating to things like Snapchat, where you share pictures and short videos, which then disappears in just a few hours. I don't know if you know this man. His name is Felix, and he's a well-known YouTuber, people who create content for YouTube. And studies reveal that YouTubers are the new popular celebrities among the younger people today. It's interesting that they are really truly influential figures for their young fans, and studies also show that they're more influential than TV or movie celebrities. And the reason is because young people perceive them as authentic and ordinary. That means I can relate to them. Felix, for instance, has over 50 million or something like that subscribers to his YouTube channel. That's the whole of Spain's population following someone and hearing what he has to say. Our United Nations report on youth affirmed that this is a world in which multinational corporations and advertising agencies are competing with family and school to become the most influential institutions in young people's lives. And I'm sure many of us know that already, though some of us have the challenge of communicating this to other people around us so that we will become more intentional in reaching out to young people. That's why I think many of us would agree when I affirm that we need to recognize that social media is today one of the main areopagus for our present and our future. We remember that Dr. Luke tells us that after arguing in the synagogue and in the marketplace in Athens, the Apostle Paul is asked by curious philosophers to present his message to the Areopagus, which was a formal court in Athens, but also was the name of a hill where people sometimes met. We don't know exactly to which one Luke was referring to, but that's secondary. The important fact is that Paul was communicating the gospel where ideas and worldviews were shaped in the world of his time. And it's interesting today that anyone from anywhere can create any content that could potentially be seen by anybody in any part of the world. And influence today, as we know, is polycentric. It comes from everywhere to everywhere. Do you know, by the way, which is the number one country in the world with the most YouTube users? It's outside of Europe, but it's interesting. It's Saudi Arabia. And the majority of them are women, mainly because they have to stay at home. And the most watched YouTube content category in Saudi Arabia is education. And of course, maybe you're thinking the same as I am. What are we doing with this unprecedented possibility of sharing the good news literally to millions upon millions who are being shaped through the content that they experience in social media, including young people in Europe? Studies also show that something that we know by personal experience, that people would access social media, and younger people, of course, through smartphones, and they would be willing to access, of course, some content in private that they would never access in public. Some of the stuff we would not like them to be watching, but topics that they may be feeling embarrassed by, even conversations about God in front of other people, is something they would be willing to be checking, for instance, in the bedroom or in the toilet. That means that social media allows us to take content to spaces that are very much private, and people would be open to consider, watch, or read within those spaces something they would never do in public because of peer pressure. I'm sure you would know of many cases. And the communication revolution, as we know, has drastically changed the way we think and decide and pay attention, donate, and relate. Some people might not like it. Some people love it. But this is not our conversation. I think our conversation is the realization that this is a fact. And if we are to reach the next generation, this is an Areopagus we should be paying attention to, which is, of course, representing a huge challenge for us as we serve and work and love young people as well. For instance, a few years ago, if a 13-year-old boy wanted to check pornography, for instance, he would have to get a magazine with perhaps an adult who would be willing to, you know, show it to him. But today, 13-year-old boys and girls have smartphones and they are able to see anything they want any time of the day. What are the repercussions that this has? I was having lunch yesterday here and talking to a guy I met. He's from Spain, but we didn't know each other before. And he's working with virtual reality, and he was sharing with us some of the projects he's seen. One of them, he says, is this thing that people are creating that allows you to meet with others through virtual reality wherever you want. Let's say three of us want to meet up in Hawaii. Through virtual reality, they create this space that is just like the place you want to be. And the three people are there meeting. And that means, of course, that you are able to choose not only the place where you meet, but how you meet. If you want to be a male or female, if you want to change yourself, you might present yourself however you want to. And this is not something that, you know, in a distant future. This is something that very soon will be happening. And some challenging things is what we are facing today, especially the youth. I was reading an article from an Australian website, but talking about a survey in the UK, and the topic was sexting. As we know, the sending or exchanging sexually explicit messages or images electronically. This was conducted by a British anti-bullying organization called Ditch the Label. Sorry, they surveyed almost 3,000 young people in the UK. And the survey revealed that 37% had sent a naked photo of themselves. And 24% had seen that image shared without their consent. It wasn't 3 or 4 or 5 or 10%. It's almost 40% of the young people had done it and is involved in such an activity. And girls, by the way, were twice as likely to send a naked photo to someone than boys, the report said, perhaps also for different pressure that they feel. And this is also interesting. Almost half of those questioned said they believed sexting was just a bit of harmless fun. And 16% said it was the normal thing to do. And of course, as in other areas of society, we see the normalization of the immoral and unethical from our Christian perspective. And the article goes on to talk about a girl called Chloe, who is 17 years old and tried to commit suicide a few times after sending a selfie of herself naked to a young man and him uploading it to YouTube. And though she wrote to you, I'm sorry, to Facebook. And though she wrote to Facebook, I think it took about 2 days for them to get the picture out. And she's been struggling with that shame since. Anyway, those are some of the challenges that we know we see in our emerging generations. That's why I really think that one of our priorities as we seek to reach the youth, and particularly the youth in Europe, is to be present, invest, and create content for social media, for technology in general, and equip our young people to use social media and to use it as a means of influencing their friends as well. Talking about this, let me just briefly share with you an initiative that some friends in Spain have developed it, thinking of social media. They created a campaign, an evangelistic campaign called Jesus on the Web. These are data from 2015, just 1 or 2 years after they had launched it. And what they've been doing is they invited some of us to create content, writing articles, some now they do some videos as well, and they give, you know, they have a good visual design, very attractive, and they organize a campaign that of course wouldn't cost them anything, and they try to mobilize churches and organizations and young leaders in Spain to work together during this week in a campaign in social media. In the 2 years ago, they touched around 300,000 people who might have been exposed to the material they were producing in several countries. Though this is, the focus is Spain, because of the language, other countries are touched as well. 1 year later, they doubled the number of people that have been exposed to that sort of material. For me, they are an inspiration, and I can give you more information later about, you know, a small case of using social media also to create content and influencing others. Secondly, I would say that one of the priorities we should have and embrace is the formation of multi-generational leadership. And that is a leadership that is formed by people from different generations. This is not necessarily the description of a multi-generational group or church. This is going beyond, and I will explain that in a minute. Are you still with me here? Yeah? I don't want to generalize, okay, but in many evangelical circles, when we have a serious concern for the emerging generations, I think we tend to create a specific youth department, a commission, or an area that is focused on reaching the youth. That is, of course, wonderful and necessary. But I want to suggest that this is not enough. And this might be one of the main reasons why we are not up to the colossal challenge in calling in front of us. I think we must go further. I would like to suggest that our core leadership circles, that could be, you know, the leadership of our church, the boards, directive teams, councils, whatever body or group of people who are shaping the organization, the church, the ministry, the movement, should be formed by people from different generations, which is different from having one department, which is necessary. I'm suggesting the main leadership team should be and could be formed by people from different generations. Multi-generational teams are more sensitive to the radical changes in our world because people from different generations have their fingers on different parts of the pulse of the world, and therefore each feed their preparation and their perception and wisdom in order to shape the response of the church, project, movement, or organization they are a part of. And this is, of course, not a new idea. It's the biblical pattern of leadership, I would say. We can think of Jesus calling young men, probably in their early 20s, to be part of his leadership team. And we could think of Apostle Paul with Timothy or Titus. Please, for instance, make a mental exercise right now. What is the age of those placed in the most influential roles of our teams, churches, organizations, and ministries? Those in the key leadership role, those who are shaping the big decisions of our ministries, organizations, and churches. What is the age group or the age they have? And I'm not saying they all should be young, surely not. I think the leadership team should be multi-generational. I must confess, this has been one of the exciting aspects of the life of C29 Granada. This is the local church, the expression of the church that some of us planted in Granada some years ago, and I have the pleasure of serving as pastor. And I have a picture of our team, by the way, formed by one who is in his late 20s, people in their 40s, my wife and I in our 30s, and Ian, who is, by the way, an ex-Harvard professor, lives in Granada with his wife now, and over 70. And it's been a huge learning experience to have people from different generations in the co-leadership of the local church, so that we can all feed in our perceptions. And someone who is 28, but with a calling and a gift to serve in this capacity, can be alongside a man who is 70-something, and they both can learn together, and this can result in decisions and vision for the local church that I believe we would never be able to have if everyone was 20-something, or if everyone was 70-something, or if everyone was 40-something. According to an article in the Harvard Business Review, for the first time in history, five generations will soon be working side by side. And that's also already a reality in some parts of the world. John Ortberg, in a very provocative article in Christianity Today called The Gap, wrote the following. There is an old saying in the church world that says the following: the issue is never the issue. The issue is always control. And when it comes to generations working together, the question of control, Ortberg says, is never more than about a micron below the surface. He also wrote, we can't say we are faithful, good luck to whoever comes next. Some time ago, Anna and our older boys and I went to a free jazz concert in Granada, where we live. It was good, it was free, so it was perfect. And traditionally, as some of us know, a jazz band is formed by four or five musicians who, although playing in the same rhythm, they each will get the chance to improvise and become the main protagonist in the concert. And the jazz culture, from the beginning, encouraged young musicians to play with more experienced ones and learn from them as they play together and were in action together. They play together, learning from each other, each having the chance to improvise. And this is really inspiring, I think. And I believe you know where I'm going. Those of us who are younger would say to the ones who are older, we want to play together. And those who are younger than we are will say to us, we want and we can play together. Now, moving forward, I want to suggest that the third priority we could and we should have as we reach out to the youth in Europe is what we could describe as verbal proclamation of God's word. Again, we cannot generalize, but I think we find in many evangelical European circles that we've lost confidence in the proclamation of the Word of God, particularly when the issue is preaching to young people. We don't have time to make an extensive examination of this reality, but let me invite you all to take a couple of minutes to reflect on our contemporary reluctance regarding the need and effectiveness of proclamation. Some say technology has diminished our attention span, and therefore people no longer want or can pay attention to discourses. If so, why have TED Talks, for instance, become so popular in our days? And people still love, you know, watching stand-up comedians and monologues. Why do speeches still move the hearts and minds of people in real life or movies, even young people, in ways that no other medium can? And some say we need to move away from one person dropping information upon others who are simply passive. But is that what really preaching is? Isn't Jonathan Edwards centuries ago right when he said that the main benefit obtained by preaching is by the impression made upon the mind at the time, and not by something that people remembered afterwards? In other words, we believe that when the word of God is proclaimed, something is happening right there in young people's lives, hearts, and minds. Some may even think that preaching is passé, is no longer necessary, especially when we talk about young people. And our learning, some may think, should always be collaborative, and the group should always dialogue and form the conclusions. And I ask myself, could one of the reasons some think like that be actually a reaction against authority, or a difficulty to submit to authority, which is so common in postmodern way of thinking and living? And could it be that hearing another human being speaking to a group, or watching a human being perform a speech act, to borrow the language from linguistics, is in front of others, resonates and connects with our intrinsic nature in ways that no other act does? And of course, I would be preaching to the choir when I try to remind ourselves that if this is real, it is real because our God is by nature a speaking God. We know God creates the world through His Word. We know that in the Old Testament, for instance, whenever God wanted to change the world or His people, He called people who spoke on His behalf. We know that the one who prepared the way for Jesus, His cousin John the Baptist, did so mainly through preaching. And the biographers of Jesus, the evangelists, quote Him saying to His followers, "We must go on to other towns as well, and I will preach to them too. That is why I came." And Dr. Luke narrates the phenomenal growth of the early church as we've been thinking together these mornings here at the forum, taking place primarily through the preaching of the apostles. And we also know that the history of the church shows us that one of the key elements in genuine revivals have been the preaching of God's word. And I don't want us to be abstract about this, and I want us to be connecting to the youth work and the youth ministry that we are developing. But all of this, I think, is a necessary reflection when we consider the work we are doing with the young people. Or is it not true that in many of our circles we've not been confident anymore that we should be communicating and proclaiming and preaching? Surely, I understand that in the past we maybe in the West and lived a very reductionist gospel that had very little to say about poverty, unfair economic system, political corruption, human slavery, social needs. But perhaps the pendulum has swung to the other side. And whenever we approach young people, we work with young people, we want to reach out to young people, we are calling them to impact their communities, we are calling them to engage in social justice, we are calling them to fight slavery, we are calling them to... And this is wonderful, but are we also calling them to evangelize their friends? Are we also calling them to be aware that some of them are being called by God to be proclaimers also, to be preachers of His word? I would dare to say something, please understand me. This is necessary, but it's also become even trendy or cool to some very young people to be engaged in ecological and social action. It is good that it's trendy, so more people are engaging with it. But it's not cool, it's not trendy to be evangelizing, to be proclaiming. And some are embracing one aspect or some aspects of the gospel, but not the need of proclamation. And we leaders need to be reflecting and reconsidering this in light of our history and biblical foundation for the proclamation. Surely, we need to rethink how we communicate. We need to rethink how we preach to young people. Much preaching is surely boring, irrelevant, decontextualized. We know that, but that's another conversation. We must definitely rethink how we do it, but not whether we do it or not. That's my opinion. Those proclaiming in European universities, media, churches, youth camps, and events in Europe continue to experience God's power and faithfulness to His word. One of the exciting projects that God is allowing us to be involved with is a program, a network for young evangelists that some of us started a few years ago in Spain. Recognizing that there wasn't any program that was offered to identify young people who were called as evangelists to proclaim the gospel in the nation, we were inspired by other international initiatives like EEI from the UK or R2E from France, and we established something called Red Timoteo, Timothy Network. That is a program for young evangelists in Spain where we try to connect them, equip them, and inspire them for this work, gathering up to more or less 30 participants twice a year. Let me suggest a third focus, a third priority as we seek to reach out to youth in Europe. Okay, I'll be quicker with this one, and this is the formation of a new generation of church planters. I think we have the privilege and the responsibility to motivate, equip, and resource a new generation of younger leaders who will form new communities of church of Jesus followers of churches. I know the situation is very different from wherever we are in Europe. We can rarely talk about Europe. We have Europes within Europe. For instance, where I am, and some of you are, in Southern Europe, we have a huge need of new expressions of the church because there are just few churches. This is a map of Spain. Not with chickenpox, it's not ill, but you see the several red spots. Those are towns and cities in Spain with more than 3,000 people without any evangelical or Protestant church. This is one of the needs, tremendous needs we have in Spain and in Europe. However, what perhaps is not happening as necessary is for us to see that those who have this burden to reach out to the young generations, those who identify such changes in our societies, have not been, I think, enough encouraged, equipped, or resourced to consider the possibility of planting new expressions of the church. Surely it's a difficult task. It sometimes is an expensive task for some. Sometimes it's a costly task, but it's a necessary task. And surely we need to be helping in various ways established expressions of the church. But at the same time, I don't think we can ever forget that we need many, many more expressions of the church. And in countries where there are several expressions of the church, we also need expressions of the church that, since its birth, has a DNA that will be connecting in ways that others cannot connect to the emerging generations. This has been our personal experience in southern Spain. We surely are learning a lot, and we're far from where we want to be. But whatever we've experienced in the last 3 years, we are confident we would not have experienced it in 30 years if we were to have tried to change an established local church in order to bring it to the point where this is. It's not better, it's not worse, it's different. And I think we need to identify and realize that we need new expressions of the church that are different, that will be connecting to aspects of society that we are not connecting. And for that to help happen, we need new church planters and we need younger church planters. And I would encourage us to think through that and become Paul to Timothy's in Europe today, and motivate them and equip them and resource them and talk about this and see who are the ones that God is raising to lead these processes. And may help, may God help us as we dream with a transformed Europe and a transformed youth in Europe. There are surely no easy answers. This task is huge. There are many more priorities we could talk about, but I wanted to bring this forth to the table before you as we talk about this. God bless you all and the work you're doing, and thank you very much for these minutes of your attention. Okay?